So please make Asho. May the sacred presence of the one who said he would abide in his teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and tread with unfaltering steps this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment.
All Buddhas throughout space and time,
all
Iron Ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas,
wisdom beyond wisdom,
Mahaparashya, Paramita.
All right. So, I made lots of handouts of all kinds of things for y'all. And we're going to start with the syllabus. So this is the Eightfold Path, class on the Eightfold Path. And so we'll just hand these out. Let y'all look at them for a second. No, I don't think it is, but I could certainly put it up online. Oh, and I got rid of my own. And I just made 35 copies. I didn't have really know for sure how many people we were going to end up with. So I'll bring more next week. It'll be fine. So this class, it's a Wednesday night class, which means that it is open to anyone. It is not, you know, there's not like requirements in terms of you have to attend the whole thing and you have to do, I mean, there will be some homework, but it won't be like if you don't do it, somebody's going to get down on your case. This is, everything that we're doing here is for your benefit, and you participate as you will. So you will see on the syllabus that this was a pretty easy class to arrange and schedule because there's eight classes and it's an eightfold path. So, you know, that makes it sort of obvious. So tonight we're doing a little introduction, and we are... That's funny because I had my own, I thought, that had all of the... times on it so that we would actually have it. There it is. But I didn't have the times on. Oh, this is this one. Yes, that one has the times. Well, that's for tonight. Yes. All right. Just a minute. I'll get myself organized here. All right. Okay. So if you look at the syllabus, the first thing I just wanted to put the background on here. We recently did an instructor training class, and one of the things they pointed out was it's a good idea to say, why do you want to do this? What's the point of doing this class? And the reason is that the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are one of the very earliest of the Buddhist teachings, and the one that almost all Buddhists agree is sort of the foundational teaching of the Buddhist path. So the Four Noble Truths is in the form of a medical model of diagnosis, cause, treatment. And the Eightfold Path is the treatment, is the method for getting out of suffering. So that's why it's pretty important. I think most of us are really interested in relieving our suffering and the suffering of others in the world. So that's the point. The rest of this is pretty self-explanatory. All right. Sure, I got this where I can see it. All right, so I'm going to move right into the Four Noble Truths. Many of you know these. A few of you may not have quite gotten them down, but the thing with the Four Noble Truths is that when it started to make sense to me, the format that they're in was when I saw that as a medical... format. So the first question is, what is the disease? The second one is, what is the cause of the disease? The third is there a cure? And the fourth is, what is the cure? So that's basically the questions that the Four Noble Truths are answering. So the first is what is the disease, and the disease is suffering. So the, basically what the Buddha is saying is that our lives, pretty much all life on earth, is marked by dukkha, which is dissatisfactoriness, which ends up being suffering. And it has to do with, you know, things just don't work out the way we want them to, right? And I think most of us can recognize that as a truth that is pretty universal in terms of our lives. The second truth is about, okay, what are the causes of this? So the causes have to do with impermanence. They have to do with uncertainty, impermanence. Things don't stay the way we want them to stay. I mean, the causes have to do with, I'm trying to hang on to things that I like, and I'm trying to push away and get rid of the things I don't like. I want things the way I want them, and if they're not like that, I'm going to be unhappy. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, why we suffer. The third noble truth says nirvana is possible, or an escape from suffering is possible. Does it mean that then everything will be going perfectly in our lives, but we will have a better way to deal with it so that we won't be suffering with it as much? And the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, which is what we're going to study in this class. So one of the things we found last fall when we did foundational teachings, when Gyoshi and Julie taught foundational teachings, is that people are really hungry for this, as long as you can apply it to your lives. So that's what we're going to be trying to do that in this class, because we find that that seems to be these basic truths, these basic teachings. There's a lot of power in these teachings, and we're going to find ways to actually apply them to our lives. So, another handout. Okay, great. Next handout. This one we're going to be using all the way through because it talks about all of the folds on the path. I tried to make these different colors so that, make sure I have one, so that I could find them. And again, as I say, I made 35 and not sure quite how we're going to come out of this. I do have one of these. Okay, so I have one more here if we need. This is something I found several years ago on the internet, and it is a pretty classically Theravadan view of the Eightfold Path. I should just mention here for a moment, for those of you who are not familiar, the two primary big divisions in Buddhist, I don't know what you would call it, in Buddhism, are Theravadan and Mahayana. The Theravadan considers themselves the more original teachings of the Buddha. They have the Pali Canon and the discourses and supposedly the words the Buddha taught. The Mahayana is has been sort of an outgrowth of that and has a kind of a different path or approach to how this all works. But both Theravadan and Mahayana go for the Four Noble Truths, at least. The Theravadins probably emphasize it a bit more than most of the Mahayana folks do, and Hakugyu is going to talk about that a little bit in a moment. So this is a pretty classically Theravadin viewpoint, but I find it useful. So, and I will note that because I just went to this website that I've put here very carefully here on the top, I went to it the other day, and they want you to download an app, and they want you to register, and they want all this stuff. That didn't happen, obviously, when I did this, because I just downloaded it and copied it onto a Word document and just been using it all over the place. So so you're welcome to try it out and see if you get any farther with it. I just said, oh, forget it. I'm not going to do all that stuff. But presumably, this is still there somewhere through whatever machinations you have to go through. And they basically have a paragraph for each of the folds of the path. And if you really get into it, you can start finding some pretty interesting things in these paragraphs. And this is going to figure in our homework after a while. So again, another sort of introduction kind of a thing. So In Zen, we tend to not emphasize the Eightfold Path as that, as a teaching in itself. And Haku is going to talk a little bit about
that. Sure. So we don't typically in Zen use the Eightfold Path as a practice path. That's not to say that we don't acknowledge it or that it doesn't have a place. Really, it's understood that the bulk of the Buddha's teachings could be really boiled down to just the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, and the rest of it's kind of extrapolation. So in the way of a little bit of history, just to couch it, I'm not going to load you up with a whole bunch of dates and stuff, and this will be short, but so in Zen, we practice with precepts usually, and that's our ethical compass, as opposed to the Eightfold Path. To be honest, I think that the Eightfold Path is much more of an umbrella teaching over that. What the monks used in the Buddhist time was the Vinaya, which was the kind of really the moral teachings, but for monastics, meaning it was to kind of keep it was the kind of community rules. Like, we're all going to agree with this. And there was an accretion over a period of several hundred years where they ended up reaching close to 253 in some books, and for the men. And, of course, women got more because they can handle more rules than we can. So they got 364 rules. But, and a lot of those had to do with, like, pregnant women and maidens and all sorts. And so I want to read you some of these rules because it's interesting how, in the time, they were very valid. And probably, if somebody took the time to write a rule down and then kind of distribute it amongst the communities, it's because it happened, the transgression happened more than once. So it's not like, oh, this one time this one thing happened. Some of them are really funny. So for instance, you can't have a bowl hoard, meaning you can't collect more than one begging bowl, because that would be kind of like, you know, stuffing them behind. So that was one. Another one was that if you have a bowl and you want to get a new bowl, it has to have at least 5 repairs to it before you can get a new bowl, so that you can't just keep getting bowls because you want a shiny one. There was no accepting of gold or silver. It doesn't talk about any other precious metals, but gold or silver. You were not allowed to consume garlic. And I guess if you're living in confined spaces, maybe that had something to do with it. You weren't allowed to shave your armpits or your privates. And I'm not sure why that was, but that was against the rules as well. So there was, you couldn't teach someone who was holding an umbrella. So there was lots of, and I'm sure in the culture of that time, they seem ridiculous and absurd to us now. But at that time, they made sense enough that where people would at least live in the community, not only to put the rules out, but the folks that were living in the community would agree to those. The transgressions were covered by a confession to the whole group, which was usually held on either the new or the full moon. I think the new moon, once a month. There were some transgressions that were egregious enough to get you kind of booted, but most of them it was like, "Well, don't do that again," kind of thing. And I guess the teaching model was that if you had to confess in front of all your peers, maybe after a couple of confessions, you'd kind of, you know, rein it in, so to speak. So we had the Vinaya, which was there, the communities, more because lay practitioners, really their job was to support the monastics. So they didn't have the same rules. It wasn't until later that the rules kind of got modified for lay practitioners as well. So these were mostly for people living in community with no possessions altogether. So the first person to use the priest. So when you ordained, you were given the set of rules. The first person of record that used the precepts in a similar form to what we have now to ordain monks was a monk named Saicho. And Saicho was a Tendai monk. Saicho was a contemporary of Kukai, who we heard about a couple weeks ago, was a Shingon monk. And they traveled to China together about the same time, about 800 Common Era. And got teachings in different parts of China and then came back to Japan. So they predated Zen. At that time, from the Kuma Rajiva, either translated or wrote a sutra called the Brahmajala Sutra. And then that sutra talks about bodhisattva precepts. So now we've kind of started to move from this Theravadan landscape into the Mahayana landscape, which starts to which is where the bodhisattva shows up, and that bodhisattva ideal of like saving all beings together with the bodhisattva, with ourselves. And So that was a kind of the Shingon and the Tendai were a Yogacara school, for those of you who are interested in these details. And it was kind of a lot more like the way Tibetan Buddhists practice today. Similar. This was an esoteric Mahayana type of, lots of ritual, lots of kind of mysticism. So, later, the founder of our sect, Ehe Dogen, went to, so at that time in Japan, the precepts were now getting used in Japan. That was all kind of written, signed off by the emperor, everything was good. Dogen went to China and met with the Kaodong school kind of head, Tendo Nyojo, and he came back and then distilled them into these 16 that we use today in our sect. So that's kind of the general idea of the precepts. So when we overlay them with the Eightfold Path, they're kind of an accretion of it, maybe even a development of it, but they're not in conflict in any way. We just don't practice. That's what we use to practice our ethics, is that 16 Bodhisattva precepts as opposed to the Eightfold Path. But it's useful to know the Eightfold Path and study it, because that's where all this stuff came from. So if we want to kind of wiggle our way back to the source, that's where we want to go with it.
You know, it occurs to me that the precepts have to do with that middle part of the Eightfold Path. So if you look on this list of the eight, mm-hmm. the first two, right view and right intention, are that's a whole thing that we will talk about tonight. But right speech, right action, and right livelihood pretty much encompass the precepts. That's where the precepts live. And the last three, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, have to do a lot more with meditation. So precepts and meditation are, in fact, the two main sort of pillars, if you will, of how we do Zen. I mean, that's what we emphasize particularly here, is meditation and the precepts, the karmic relation work that we do with the precepts. So it's all there. It's just organized a little differently and emphasized a little differently. Okay. So now I want to talk about the word right. So we have right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. What do you think right means in this context? Ideas?
Yeah. I took another class on this.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So it means if you do it this way, you will move towards enlightenment as opposed to away from enlightenment.
Okay, so tending towards enlightenment, that might be one way to think of it. Other ideas?
Ways that don't increase suffering.
Things that don't increase suffering. Okay, another way to think of it.
The intention behind it.
The intention behind it. Say more about that.
So it's not so much like right or wrong, but just like holding the idea or like keeping it. That's really all I had, was just the intention behind it.
Okay. Well, we do know that intention does matter. We do know that. As it happens, I have another handout that has a whole list of these possible words to think about, which is in here somewhere. Actually,
what is the Pali word?
What?
What is the Pali?
Sama.
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 Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sama or
Samyak in Sanskrit.
Uh-huh. Right. Pass those around. So, yeah. I think I've got it here. So some of these are kind of fun, actually. I've generated these lists from various classes that I have taught over the years. And then Haku had a few more, so I've added those. I just kind of keep adding more words that might be right to this list. So we have perfect or perfected, complete, thorough, full. Our best ability, our best intention, so there's your intention there. Positive, holistic, wholesome, wholehearted, healthy, sound, integral or integrated, authentic, honest, proper or appropriate, ethical, moral, following the precepts, non-exploitive, non-destructive, non-harming. That's what Kai was talking about. Not generating harmful karma, expedient, skillful, effective, successful. That's one of my favorites. Does it work? Aligned with one's being, in harmony with one's being or Buddha nature. Aligned with an inner guide, same kind of thing. Compassionate, open, unobstructed by knowledge. I love that one. Let's see. Out of the head, ego, and into the heart. Beneficial, uplifting, and I think I don't have all of the ones on. Are there more on that one?
Accurate, correct.
Correct.
Wise.
Right? Wise, that's a nice one.
True or real.
Uh-huh.
And harmonious.
And harmonious, okay. So, yeah.
I've seen lists that don't have right understanding, right intention. So, why put it in there?
What an excellent question. It was the next thing on my syllabus.
Okay.
She's a shill.
So, that's a great question. What are the advantages of using right or one of these other words? And what are the advantages of not using it? What do you think?
It matters how.
It matters how. You have to sort of points us in a direction, right?
Seems like, I mean, with right speech, it makes all the difference in the world, uh-huh. whether how you use it, there's a right and wrong, usually in terms of evil or good.
Okay, and so I think right and wrong and good and evil are one of the reasons to not use the word right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? No?
It's a trap.
Well, it has this weight on it. It has this connotation to it and what happens, I think, is that people start identifying with it, right? So I did that right, so that means I'm a good person, and I live my life correctly, and I'm wise, and I'm all these things, you know. And I did it wrong, that means I'm a bad person. Yeah.
There's also many different rights, so there's not one right way, so we might get trapped by that as well.
That's true. Right can mean all kinds of different things. Right.
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 When we were talking about this, we were just like saying right all over the place, and it was just like cracking us up. So.
I was just reading that it says the right view is the beginning and the end of the path, and it seems kind of a theme that if you keep taking a right, you end up back where you
begin. Like NASCAR. Just left, but yeah.
Great. So I have seen lists that don't have the word right. And Refuge Recovery is one of those places I've seen that, and there's another couple of places that I've seen where they leave it off altogether because they don't necessarily want to get into this whole business of trying to judge, you know, right and wrong and true and false and good and evil. But it's true also that it's helpful to have that, and I think it's implied. You know, obviously there's a direction that you want to go when you're talking about understanding. You want to understand correctly. You want to understand what's true. You don't necessarily want to understand something that's wrong, right? So, right? You get kind of crazy with this thing. And I kind of like it in a way, but I noticed that Refuge Recovery on their latest printout that I got from them about sort of the little trifold brochure that we have back here, they're now using the word wise. So wise understanding and wise speech. And that's kind of nice because it's a little less loaded. That was the word I was looking for earlier, was this loaded, there's loaded with all of this kind of baggage about, you know, you're a good person, you're a bad person, whatever. So.
Well, that's what I like so much about the tending towards enlightenment, is that,
that's
so
a nice one.
So you have an intention or you have this way-seeking mind that arises, mm-hmm. right? So if you're going to be developing that way-seeking spirit, right? There's going to be a way that's useful to do that, and a way that's not going to work for you so well. Right. So, and the Buddha was pretty clear about that. We had a choice to do that. There is a way that's tending towards enlightenment, and a way that tends towards delusion. And I think that can even be elastic, depending on where we are in our practice and who we are. You know, it gets pretty flexible there. I think, if we're honest with ourselves. Yes.
So I think it's helpful if we think about it in practical terms rather than judgmental terms.
Mm-hmm.
So what this the Noble Eightfold Path is saying is, well, we've observed that if you behave in such a way, that tends towards happiness. If you behave in another way, that tends towards suffering. So
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a neutrality to it. It's not so personal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just observing, as you say, this is the way things happen. That's why I like effective and what works for you, you know. That one works for me. But I think that's true. It takes some of that loaded baggage out of there to where it's just, you know, that's the whole thing about Dharma. I like the translation of Dharma as law, as in law of gravity. You know, you can have your opinions about the law of gravity, but you are expressing it perfectly whether you are walking, dancing, or falling down. And what this is saying is, wouldn't you rather dance than fall down? Let's do it this way, because that'll work better. And so it's just a matter of, this is how it works.
When I think about the word right, I just think, like, there are moments in your life when you feel that sense of rightness with the world.
That is true.
Like, there's this, like, ease and stillness in your body. Like, whatever else is happening, it still is right in that moment. There's, like, an alignment that happens. Mm-hmm. And that's not judging or not. It's just the...
It's a recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There's a very felt sense of it.
Uh-huh. And I think that's part of what we're cultivating when we sit on the cushion and, you know, still the mind and kind of let everything settle down to where something inside comes up and says, oh, that's, you know. One of the ways I tell people about how to know what's the right thing to do or what's true at any moment is you need to really settle down and do the interior work. And I have the sense that opportunities come by all the time. And most of the time, we don't even see them. But once we've identified, this is a direction I want to go, something will come up and you'll say, there. Mm-hmm. There it is. Mm-hmm. And there is that sense of rightness. Mm-hmm. And that, so that, in that sense of rightness, I think that's what we're talking about here. Yeah. Okay? Thoughts about that? So this is all introductory, but you know, you have to kind of go through some of this first, get a sense of this, and I might as well throw out my last handout here, almost the last handout.
What will we do at the end, if you have no handouts left?
Well, I have a couple more.
Oh, there's more. Good.
I mean,
the encore handouts.
Yeah, I mean, you know. Okay, so now we're going to talk about right understanding or right view. And again, all of these have, just as with the word right, there's a bunch of different words that end up being used for these. I think I've seen understanding and view pretty much about the same amount of time for each, you know, different translations, and they pretty much all come down to those two. And I thought, for me, one of the things that was helpful for me in getting a sense of this is to start thinking about what would a wrong view or a wrong understanding look like. So I'm going to have us do a little activity. One more hand back. And what I want you to do is, I want you to stop and think for a little bit, just on your own, about at least one wrong view that you have held in your life. I think if most of us think about it, we could probably come up with one or two of those. What made it wrong? How do you know? How did you find your way out of it? And write down a few notes if that's helpful for you. And I'm going to hand this out so that you have a little piece of paper to write down notes. And there's pens if you need a pen. And then once we've done that, I'll give you a couple of minutes to do that, and then I'm going to have you turn to a partner, so, you know, figure out who your partner's going to be, and share that. And I'll ring a bell when it's time first to turn to your partner, and then another one when it's time to switch. Okay? So.
Are we defining wrong?
What?
Are we defining the word wrong?
You can define the word wrong the way we define the word right, if you like. But I think Lena's right that we have a sense of it, you know, and that's part of the whole discussion, is trying to get a sense of what is this business of right and wrong. And in this case, we're talking about view or understanding. Oh. Yeah, feel free to grab a pen. And I'll give you a couple minutes, and then I'll ring a bell for you to start sharing. Discussions going on here. What did y'all come up with? What are some of the wrong views that people have had? My guess is that whatever you come up with, somebody else will have held the same one. So don't be shy.
I'm not good enough.
What was that?
I'm not good enough.
I'm not good enough. Oh boy, is that a big one. Yeah. How many people in this room have felt they were not good enough? Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, I think that's a really common wrong view that we have. And it takes a lot of work to get out of that one.
I have the kind of opposite one. Well, I've had that one plenty of times. But I know best. I know the way. I know I make good decisions. I'm small.
What do you got, Adam?
I felt that it was perfectly fine to pass judgments on total strangers.
Yeah. We see a lot of that out there, too, don't we?
It happens, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Any others?
Why does this always happen to me?
It only happens to me. I'm somehow unique in the universe. Well, and I am, but...
Right. I have a repeat, but Kevin, there's a right way and a wrong way to do things.
Yes. That whole question of right and wrong right there from the beginning. Yeah.
I shouldn't need to ask for help.
You what?
I shouldn't need to ask for help. I should be able to do it by myself.
Oh, right. I don't need help. Because
I can just alone in the universe doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do it all by myself, all the time. Right. What?
You know the whole saying, ignorance is bliss? For a really long time, I used to hate people who were happy because I thought that they must be ignorant.
Interesting.
It was a wrong view. I know that because thinking that caused me a lot of suffering.
You know, I think that's coming from a place of you know, we don't want to appear that we're ignorant. We don't want to be gullible. We don't want to be sort of feeling like we're being fooled. So we just doubt everything. Mm-hmm. And so then we're not happy. Mm-hmm. And people who are happy clearly are fools and are gullible and are, you know, whatever.
I'm glad I'm not gullible.
Right.
They actually made a bumper sticker. If you're not angry, you're not paying attention.
Right.
Just like that. You like it.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Okay, others?
If I just try harder.
If I just try harder, oh boy, is that a good one. So what about some of these other questions about, you know, Ember started to talk about how do you know, how do you know that it's wrong? How did you figure that out? And then what happened to change that view?
Well, after years of driving myself into the ground with exhaustion, trying harder the same way over and over again, and realizing, this isn't working.
This isn't working for you, yeah.
Like, you know, if you bang your head on the wall too many times, eventually you start to figure out, oh, maybe that's causing my headache.
Yeah, and some of us, it takes a long time, doesn't it? Yeah. What do you have?
I had a similar one of both sides feeling better or not feeling good enough, but both of those are very alienating, isolated, and kind of you're cutting yourself off.
So it has to do a little bit with beginning to recognize what's going on, right? You have to kind of get to that point where it's like, wait, this isn't working, you know, and so now I need to try to do something different, right? Yeah. Any other ideas about how we do this? Yeah, Evan.
Oh, or how I found out that it was wrong?
Yeah.
Well, I think casting judgments is kind of like gambling. You start losing a lot. Your currency, you kind of run out and you realize you probably shouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, you kind of lose your stake there, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, for me, it was like realizing that I was kind of like having a very shallow view of mine was more like thinking that people who had different political views were clearly, didn't they know they were bad?
Uh-huh.
And then one day I was like, oh, maybe there's another side to the story. Uh-huh. And then that.
Maybe there's a little more complexity than I was being aware of. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And for me, sometimes I found that I have the awareness that I'm not the person that I think I am.
Uh-huh.
There's that dawns on you, and that's really like a, well, or like you want to be one way, you know, that's your heart's desire, and you may even think you're pulling it off, and then, but in reality, there's like either through serendipity or through exhaustion, you know, you find out that that's really not the case, and so how do I reconcile that, and that's often the change agent there.
I found this the same sort of thing, but having a certain image of myself that was very limiting, and then. Forming the intention of changing that, and found that the way to do that was with small successes, small steps. Give myself, you know, for instance, I saw myself as a very shy person who didn't know how to make social conversation, and so a small success was talking about the weather with somebody, and then moving on from there.
So this is also getting into intention, which is next week. We're going to be talking about that next week. But so this is one of the ways these all play into each other. So this handout I just passed out before was it shows that the Eightfold Path is in the shape of the graphic is the spokes of a wheel, and that shows that they're all connected to each other, and it's a circle. I remember the time when I saw them laid out in a list and got down to right meditation, right concentration. I thought, oh, it's just a circle. It goes back then to understanding. So you can think of it going through the whole thing and then coming back to understanding. So any of these can be the beginning or the end of the path if you want to think of it that way. I think that's part of what happens is that I really like the way you put that, Ahaku, the business about you have a sense of yourself and who you are and who you want to be and, you know, this is my aspiration and so, that's who I am. But one of the things we do when we set an intention, which is, as I say, next week, is we start seeing the ways that that's not quite true. You know, it's kind of like, but really, I'm not quite there yet. So beginning to see ourselves more clearly and see the things around us more clearly is a big part of what this particular right understanding or right view is about. So with that, I'm going to turn that back over to Haku to talk about this particular...
Yeah, so right view, in some ways, is kind of the beginning and the end of the path, in the way that you can think about beginnings and ends, when you're talking about kind of non-dual... It's a more holistic approach. You know, you can... Actually, I have something... One of the texts that I've been using for study has been this, the Noble Eightfold Path, and it's by Bhikkhu Bodhi, so he's a Theravadan monk, and it's available all over the place for free online as a download. So I highly recommend it. He has he's a Westerner, so he has a Western way of putting things in perspective. And one of the things he talks about is exactly that, is that there, so I'll read just this one paragraph, and I'll talk a little bit outside the book. The eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are not steps to be followed in sequence one after another. They can be more aptly described as components rather than steps. Comparable to the intertwining strands of a single cable that requires the contributions of all the strands for maximum strength. With a certain degree of progress, all eight factors can be present simultaneously, each supporting the others. So that's the way that they're all happening at the same time. However, until that point is reached, some sequence in the unfolding of the path is inevitable. Considered from the standpoint of practical training, the eight path factors divide into three groups: the moral discipline group, made up of right speech, right action, and right livelihood; the concentration group, made up of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration; and the wisdom group, which we're kind of talking about the first of that today, which is the made up of right view and right intention. These three groups represent three stages of training: the training in the higher moral discipline, the training of the higher consciousness, and the training of the higher wisdom. So that's how Theravadins use that as a training idea. They also, he talks about in the book an idea of a mundane level of understanding. That doesn't mean base. I mean, I think you could take it that way. And then a superior level of understanding. So we all start off walking baby steps. And in the base sense, right view is really about understanding how karma works. Maybe not completely in the depth that the Buddha did in the second watch of his enlightenment night, where he got the whole thing at once, but in seeing that how we do this thing and this happens, we do this thing and this happens, and how we have to really own that. So when we talk about right view, we're not exactly talking about like a view as like an opinion, right, or a attitude. We're really talking about having the kind of obscurations clear. We're really talking about having that muddy glass of water kind of being allowed to settle, so that the view can just be, so we can see first. And part of that seeing is how we understand our karma. And in the superior view, then that gets transformed into how we can use that towards a level of enlightenment. So in the mundane view, we're looking at our karma, we're looking at how our lives work in that view, and we're looking at that through the window of the Four Noble Truths, right? And really all of the Eightfold Path kind of at once, in whatever way we can understand that. And then we take that view and allow that to kind of work on us. We can stop at the level of like, well, if we do good things, we get good things, right? I mean, and that's okay, right? If I behave nice to my neighbors, I get, you know, I have a nice day, and if I am honest with things, then maybe I'm successful in whatever my endeavors are. So there's that level. Then there's the superior level where we're really talking about the way-seeking mind that wants to have liberation. And it's a little bit different level. Then you've penetrated the idea of karma, as opposed to simply like been able to give the instructions of how it seems to work, if that makes any sense. You've incorporated it by penetrating. Really, it's more a matter of that view penetrating us than it is us penetrating the view. Maybe both are happening. So that's really right from right view kind of leads all to the rest. And if we want to look at them in order, we can do that, because there is a certain order to it that makes sense. And then when we get to the end and we have that concentration and that mindfulness, that kind of leads back into a more refined version of right view. So we're constantly, it's constantly feeding itself in our practice. And they, as Genko had mentioned earlier, in the original teaching, well, for one, the Buddha really, in the beginning, didn't think we'd even understand it. So we're very grateful that he decided to break it down in a better way for us than what happened to him all at once. And in that way, I find it as a path to work through that. I also like the idea of a real view as opposed to right view. I like the word real a little bit better because, one, my reality is constantly being refined, and it runs up against that idea of delusion. So I can have a deluded view, or I can have an actual view. And that's a constant refinement for me. So any thoughts on that?
Actually, you know, one of the things that occurs to me about this is that the Theravadin view on this one, one of the things I like about the word view is that it gets a little bit out of understanding. Sounds pretty intellectual. And so view has to do with how am I seeing it, which... it's not quite right either, but how am I perceiving it? How am I perceiving this thing? And that's a little different way of thinking of it, so that it's not just, I got this down, I got this figured out, because I can diagram and I can write mm-hmm. it out, you know? So that's part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
So even though this is one of the things in this Theravadin way of looking at it, it says it's the cognitive part. It has to do with understanding the Four Noble Truths. And that's true. And at the same time, I think that there's more to it than that. So
I wouldn't mind hearing from other people what their take on view is.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? What does that mean to you? I mean, I can say what it means to me, and Bhikkhu Bodhi can say what it means to him, but what does it mean to people in the room?
That's a good question. Yeah, Amber?
Shoot, my thought isn't that well put together.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said my thought isn't very well put together.
Oh, okay.
But when I'm thinking view, I was thinking about almost like having broad horizons.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the best way I can put
it. So seeing farther than just, you know, right here.
Yes.
But being able to open that out farther. Uh-huh. I think that's part of it, right? Mm-hmm.
Definitely seems like more of a 360 degree type of where understanding can get fixed, because we can think we understand. It's like, well, I now understand. Why do I need to look at it any other way? But a view, you have a mountain, but you see it from different angles.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. You get a different understanding of the composition of it with everything else in its surroundings.
That's kind of that complexity that we were talking about earlier, that there's a different way to look at things.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Perspective.
Yep.
Yes, that part of right view is seeing my part in things.
Uh-huh.
You know, when things don't go well, and you know, I don't know why the universe is doing this to me, and and then coming to see, oh, I'm, you know, maybe not doing things as skillfully as I should, or you know, I'm not being the person that I thought I was, and I'm creating, you know, this.
And I think that works both ways, is that sometimes it's real easy to blame ourselves. So that precept we have about blaming self or blaming others, it's all about trying to say it's somebody's fault. And I think it really helps a lot to kind of back away from that a little bit and say, here's my part and here's maybe somebody else's part that I'm not wanting to acknowledge, that I need to kind of look at more clearly. Yeah.
Maybe like the filter with which we see the world, like the filter. You know, if it's all muddy with delusion or if it's
Helps kind of settle that, like we talked about, sort of settling out the mud a little bit so that you can see better. Good job.
I almost see view in a small way. I think of driving around and I see a sign that says viewpoint ahead.
Uh-huh.
Off the road. And I get out of the truck and I look around and there it is, but it's one viewpoint. It's a very large area. But then when I'm driving and I go on the next turn, I'll crane my head over the other way. That's a totally different thing.
Yeah. Kind of like what we're talking about over here.
It's all it is what I'm seeing is this exact moment. It's not, I don't think it's true. It's a one way look at it, but it's not a totality.
Right. Those different perspectives. Yeah, Amber.
I have a question. How do we know when we're not deluded?
You are a show. I was just going to bring that up and say, I was going to flip it around and say, thank you.
Yeah, how do you know? Anybody have a foolproof way?
I don't know that you can ever know for sure, but something that came to mind for me in thinking about right view is that I think in Western culture, we have this very compartmentalized understanding of how to relate to the world. Like, you can look at something through a microscope, or you can look at something through a telescope, and you like pick your specific view. But I think there's something in this concept that view is a process, not one moment, and that it's about how you are relating to what you're seeing. You're having a conversation or interaction.
Mm-hmm. It's dynamic.
It's not that process that you talked about of you have the viewpoint at one twist in the road and then you go somewhere else and it's the same mountain but a different viewpoint from it. It's that dynamic thing, and the delusion comes when you only stop at one viewpoint.
Yeah, you may kind of get stuck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it feels like an opening.
Uh-huh. Adam, did you have something?
Yeah, I was going to say just ask somebody. Maybe somebody you trust.
Yeah.
I have a teacher. I have like a comment about that. I like your question a lot. Because I live with a lot of self-doubt, like way too much is one of the things I'm working on. And so I'm just constantly questioning, am I delusional? Is this just a delusion now? And what I do is I experiment.
Right.
But I want to say I fully believe that intuition is a solid source of information, or like a solid source. And so if you feel like maybe I'm delusional, that's a good time to do a little experiment and see, or talk to someone, see, like listen to that intuition, and it's helped me.
You can quiet it down and hear that voice.
I would say about knowing whether we're deluded or not is that it's always a process and a progression. So as we practice on this path with zazen, with living according to the precepts, and we move forward, I think that we become less and less delusional, but there's never an end to it. So I may say, well, you know, today I'm so clear-sighted, I'm not deluded about this thing, but I'm going to make progress, and you know, tomorrow or in 3 months, then my vision will be clearer. So it's always moving in the direction of less and less delusional, but I don't know that it's ever black and white.
I think it's fair to say we're all delusional, but it's like what percentage?
So our practice never ends, but this class does. And so...
Nice.
Yeah.
This isn't a slumber party.
I know, wouldn't that be nice?
Saturday night. We're going to have all the kids in here.
So I'm going to... I have one more handout, the very last one, which has to do with homework. So we have two different things. And again, this is not something that you are, you know, required to do at all. So the first one has to do with what we talked about tonight, understanding and view. So this very first paragraph of right understanding on our blue sheet here, it's pretty dense. These paragraphs are pretty dense. There's a lot to them. So what we're suggesting is pick one sentence from this paragraph that kind of speaks to you. Find an example in your life during this week that it might apply to, and what did you notice about that? An option is to consider using it as part of your daily meditation. So here's the sentence that I'm paying attention to this week, and when you sit down to meditate, look at it, and then kind of see if something comes up or not, but, you know, kind of notice that. And then report back next week. So that's the first one. The second one is looking towards next week, which is intention and what else do we call it? Vow or aspiration, or there's a bunch of things you can call it. How does your understanding lead you to form an intention? So we've talked tonight a little bit about the relationship between understanding and intention and how one leads to the other. And in fact, intention, forming an intention can increase our understanding. It's another way to think about it. But explore that a little bit and see what that process is like for you. And we'll talk about that a little bit more next week. Okay? So I'm going to hand these out. And it has the paragraph on it. So... very, very good.
Thank you.
So, I have this clipboard here, which Yoshi, when he did his class, he had like a whole, you know, flip chart kind of a thing where people could write down resources. I have a clipboard, and I've got the name of the book and various things on here. I can, again, make this available to everyone. We can put it on the website. That would be fine under the classes section. So I'm going to put a bunch of this stuff up there so people can see it. But if you have other resources that you're also interested in or that you find that are useful for this, feel free to write it on here. So I will bring this every week, and so we'll have them here. So feel free to take a look at this, and as I say, I'll put it on the website. Any other last burning questions?
Not friendship, but like regarding the delusion. I think it's cultural difference. Uh-huh. In Japanese, we say moso. But when I hear delusion, which is moso, somehow it gives me like positive image. It's more like using your imagination and creating something that's not happening right now. So like when I hear delusion, like maybe in English sense, I'm like, am I delusional to think delusion is good? You know, like right? I think that's how we use English. But like delusional, like moso. When I say use delusion, it just doesn't have the negative meaning. So I thought it was interesting.
That is interesting because I think usually when we use the word delusion, particularly in a Buddhist context, we're talking about wrong view.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what we're talking about.
Right.
Sort of this somehow a belief or an understanding that is actually not correct.
Maybe like current Japanese language, it maybe kind of switched. And then when I hear more so like delusion, it's like, that's a good
one. That sounds like fun. All right, so thank you all for your great participation. This has been a lot of fun for us. Mm-hmm. And next week we'll get on to intention and vow.
I will croak my way through Vespers in about 5 minutes.